James Hughes is excited about this post-human world. He's the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association and the author of Citizen Cyborg, Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future. He says our bodies and our brains are needlessly limited, and we can make them stronger, healthier, and smarter. And he told Anne Strangechamps, it will happen sooner than we think.
There's a general trend towards miniaturization and mastery of matter at a molecular level that will cause a convergence of nanotechnology, genetics, and probably also information technology, and then cognitive science. We call this in the field NBIC, or nano-bio-info-cogno convergence. And as a consequence, we'll have a level of control over the human body and brain that is quite dramatic.
Well, let's play some of it out. I mean, for instance, what kinds of brain changes could you imagine?
Well, I think there's a natural continuity from the things that we already want to do with the brain, which is cure various kinds of mental illnesses, one of which is depression. But once we cure people who are chronically unhappy, we also then notice that there are some people, the top 10% of the population, who are chronically happier than the rest of us. And so one of the things that we'll probably want to do is give people the ability to jack up their innate happiness to whatever level they think is best, you know, whatever level works best for them.
How would we manage to engineer chronically optimistic people? Currently, we don't think that's under our control.
Well, it's obviously eventually going to be under our control because this is all neurochemistry. This is serotonin uptake and neuroreceptors and whatnot. So we have an increasing understanding of which neuroreceptors are involved, of the genetic determinants of mental illness and mood and predisposition and personality. So whether it comes from a gene, whether it comes from a pill, or whether eventually we get a kind of nano-cybernetic control over the brain that allows us to turn it on with a flick of a switch, one way or the other, we'll eventually be at that point.
What about intelligence? I know a lot of transhumanists talk about this coming point when we'll be able to merge artificial intelligence and the human brain. What exactly do people mean when they talk about that?
For instance, one aspect of intelligence is the ability to have access to and to manipulate large amounts of memory, large amounts of information, your simple ability to learn. We already are surrounding ourselves with devices. So when you carry around a cell phone or a smartphone with a bunch of your numbers recorded in it, that's part of an enhancement of your mental functioning. Eventually, those things will move into our head and be directly wired up to our brain.
How do you think this will work? I mean, we'll have a little plug-in in our brains that will hook us up to our own personal supercomputers?
Well, the first step's already being taken in the direction of this with a company called CyberKinetics, which is putting chips in the brains of people with severe paralysis. It's allowing them to control computers and have two-way communication between computers and their brains. Part of the miniaturization is that, yes, eventually we'll have tiny little wires or tiny little nanobots communicating directly with our neurons in our brain.
It sounds like techno-telepathy, you know, all the kind of psychic abilities people sort of wish they had, except we'll just be able to engineer it so that, what, you'll be able to beam a thought to somebody else?
Yeah, that's already happening, as a matter of fact. Between the patients who have these cyberkinetic chips in their brains, they can think directly into a computer and out into the web and into other people's heads. So, yeah, I think we will have cyber telepathy in this century.
A lot of the changes you're talking about would involve genetic manipulation, you know, discovering the genes for empathy or compassion or optimism or even intelligence and boosting those, jacking them up. How does this differ from eugenics, which has, you know, a very negative, complex history? I mean, aren't we just entering an era of commercial eugenics?
Well, my definition of eugenics would be a movement that proposed to improve the human race through coercive measures that encouraged selective breeding. It was based on a series of classist and racist and completely unscientific notions about what the genetic determinants and correlates were of things like mental retardation. And as a consequence, there was this terrible history, not only in the United States, of coercive sterilization, but also the Nazi eugenics. What I think our new era of genomics involves is giving people information about their own genomes, about what reproductive options they have accessible to them, and what kinds of children they might be able to have through genetic enhancement and genetic manipulation of their own reproductive cells and allowing them to make those choices. And I think that's an entirely different scenario.
Do you worry at all about, you know, say, the very wealthy people choosing to engineer perfect babies with superior Stephen Hawking-style intelligence and outstanding Olympic-style athletic abilities and telepathic abilities and people who are incredibly optimistic also? I mean, does that frighten you?
Of all the worries that people have about human enhancement technologies, that is the principal one that I worry about, which is that there is a potential here for the exacerbation of inequality between an already unacceptably unequal world, and that what we need to be working on, just as if you had the example with literacy, you know, when you teach some kids to read, and inevitably the wealthy and more affluent get to learn to read quicker in most societies than the poor, it's certainly true that that gives the kids who learn to read a differential advantage and can exacerbate inequality in those societies. But your response shouldn't be, therefore, we shouldn't teach anyone to read. It should be, we should teach everyone to read as quickly as possible.
It strikes me that there are a couple of different kinds of changes you're talking about making. I mean, I don't think anybody would suggest that there's anything wrong with trying to continue to eliminate various diseases and human problems. But then there's a whole cosmetic side to what you're talking about, enhancing normal human abilities. I guess one of the things I'm wondering is why? And aren't we smart enough?
No, I don't think we are. I think we could all stand to be quite a bit smarter and quite a bit happier and quite a bit healthier and quite a bit more long-lived. Those are things which are intrinsically valuable to each of us and which makes society much richer if we all enjoy them.
Do you think there's any benefit to some of the negative aspects to being human? Sadness, depression, struggle? Aren't those experiences characteristics that we learn enormous amounts from?
Well, I'm a Buddhist, and in the Buddhist teachings, they say that no matter what you got, you could always have more. So there's always going to be the dissatisfactoriness that lurks behind the fact that you want more than what you have. And so I think that'll probably be true. When we have 1,000-year lifespans, we'll want 2,000-year lifespans. When we have the ability to think great thoughts, we'll want to think even greater thoughts. And so, yes, I think there'll always be disappointment in life. But the simple argument that fixing something about society or about the human condition somehow removes necessary suffering that we're learning from, I think, is a barbarous one. I think that that's an argument for complete stasis.
What kind of safeguards would you put in place around this technology, or would you put any in place?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a safeguard kind of guy. I believe that the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, for instance, should regulate human genetic modification, both in people's bodies, which we call somatic, and in the reproductive cells, which we call germline genetic modification.
On the other hand, if the history of technology shows us anything, it's that once a new technology is developed, it's pretty much out of the box. And, you know, it will be used by humans in some cases for benign purposes, but in some cases for evil purposes.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you can use a hammer to build a building, or you can hit somebody with it. I think that there will be many different abhorrent uses of genetic and nano and information technologies in the future. And the best thing that we can do is have open, democratic, accountable societies that ensure that we have good discussions about what those potential uses might be, anticipate them. We have a good functioning police force. We have regulatory agencies that try to build in prophylactic measures against them. And if we have those kind of measures, I think we'll basically muddle through just as we've done in the past.
It's hard to see how this technology would not increase social inequality, at least at first, because most of these developments will come about commercially, you know, and we won't be able to afford to make them available just to everybody.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think if you look at medical technology, most of the things which improve the quality of life for people in the developing world, you know, the reduction in death from infectious disease and whatnot, were not expensive interventions. And then you had things like vaccines, which are not expensive interventions. If we had, for instance, a vaccine which easily changed people's genomes to reduce their propensity to aging or increase their cognitive ability, that could be mass-produced for 50 cents a shot and given to everyone in the developing world. So it could be that some of these interventions would be extremely cheap. Now, at the other end, I'm sure there will always be things that people who, with great wealth and power, will have access to that the rest of us don't. The question there is, do we have democratic societies that can guarantee universal access to the really important stuff and control the unequal wealth of the super powerful?
And this movement you've been talking about has been dubbed the transhuman movement. Sort of suggests what we're talking about is some fundamental redefinitions of what it means to be human, what it means to be a person. Is that right?
I prefer what it means to be a person because human really doesn't have much content to it. I think increasingly we will see when we look at the genomes of humans and great apes, for instance. Right now, for instance, Jeremy Rifkin and Stuart Newman, two anti-tech activists, have applied for a patent for humanzees, half human, half chimpanzee. And they want the U.S. Patent Office to make a ruling that will draw a line and say, if you've got this much human genome, you're not able to be patented anymore because that would violate our prescriptions against slavery. That's an absurd way to approach the question, because what really is important is if you look in a chimpanzee's eyes and you ask him, you know, who are you, what kind of rights do you have, and they answer back, I'm so-and-so and I would like to go to law school so I can defend myself before the Supreme Court, that's the kind of being that we need to have the protection of rights for. So it doesn't make any difference whether they're human or not. It's a matter of whether they're the kind of being that thinks and feels the same way we do. And as we see an increasing diversity of post-humans and transhumans, people who have modified themselves in various ways, or creatures like genetically modified animals who think and feel the same way human beings do, we need to recognize their rights and not draw this arbitrary boundary around the human genome circa, you know, 1950 and say this is exactly what we're defending.
James Hughes is the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association, a professor of health policy at Trinity College in Connecticut, and the author of Citizen Cyborg. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.